Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 269. Python 3.14 is here. Christopher Trudeau returns to discuss the new version along with Real Python team member Bartosz Jaczynski. This year, Bartosz coordinated the series of preview articles with members of the Real Python team and wrote this showcase tutorial, Python 3.14, Cool New Features for You to Try. Christopher's video course, What's New in Python 3.14, covers the topics from the article and shows the new features in action. Christopher and Bartosz dug into the release to create code examples of the new features for the tutorial and course. We look at the enhanced and more colorful REPL experience, better error messages, safer hooks for live debugging, and deferred annotation evaluation. We also discuss template strings, Z-standard compression, and multiple performance improvements. We share our thoughts on the updates and offer advice about incorporating them into your projects. We also discuss when you should start running Python 3.14. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, it's Python release time. Python 3.14 is here, and I've brought a couple of people you probably recognize. I've had Bartosz Jaczynski on the show a couple times, so welcome back, Bartosz.
Thank you. It's great to be back here on the show.
And you've written the article for us this year, the Python 3.14, Cool New Features for You to Try.
Yes, that's exactly true. That's the title. We also did a bunch of preview tutorials that focus on various different features that we wanted to highlight.
Yeah.
That would lead up to this final release.
And Christopher Trudeau, my frequent co-host here, is back, and he's done a video course that also released this week. So we're here to discuss Python 3.14, the literal Pi release, as we'll talk about. Yeah. And we divided up a lot of the topics across all of us, and it's going to be a little, a little jumbled in the sense that we wanted to make sure that everybody got a chance to talk about various features inside of it. And all of us have different backgrounds and different areas of focus. So are you guys ready to dig in?
All set.
Sure.
All right. So I'm going to start, and mine is starting about the REPL. Python's REPL is its interactive mode, the read, evaluate, print loop. That's the thing that starts when you type in Python or Python 3 at the command line in your terminal. And the REPL hasn't changed a lot over my time, but 3.13 added a bunch of features and 3.14 kind of stacks on top of them. And so 3.13 added the ability to edit blocks of code, a long overdue feature, and I'll detail a couple more of those as I go, but 3.14 added two sort of key items here. Tab completion is something that was added in 3.13, but they've improved it a bit more by adding the ability to work with imports. So if you start to type the beginning of something you want to import, import req, and it could finish that as request when you hit tab. And they've also added colors in 3.13, but now they've moved toward almost full-on syntax highlighting. Though you do need a terminal that supports ANSI colors. So most people who are using the REPL inside there probably have a terminal that does that. But one note, you can control the coloring if you like. It isn't part of the public interface, and it may not be that stable. Lay It On Us wrote a very elaborate tutorial about this, and Christopher's video course actually dives into it a bit more also about how to alter the palette if you would like it to be more specific to something you like. Chris wasn't a big fan of the red for comments, which I agree is a strong choice. It makes it look a little bit more like an error. A couple other changes, again, mentioning 3.13. If you haven't been keeping up, there were quick REPL commands for like exit, quit, help, and clear. They're now just commands instead of having to be functions that required the parentheses. There's a built-in help browser. You press F1 to open up help. Persistent history browser, F2 for your command history, multi-line editing, I mentioned briefly before, but you can actually copy and paste large chunks of code instead of just single line stuff, and you can go in and edit them before you hit enter, which is really cool. The written tutorial dives way deeper into this, and a link will be included in the show notes for all these things that I talk about and my fellow hosts here. Another quick update that I'm going to just mention, there'll be a few of these going through there, is the JSON tool that you might be using to pretty print your output. Speaking about working in the REPL again, you used to have to type in python-m json.tool, and now it's been changed to just having to type python-m json and then your name of the file. So the old way works, but they're sort of softly deprecating its use. And that change was submitted by Trey Hunter, who we've mentioned a few times in the show. So I'll include links to the 3.13 update and the 3.14 update. And then also I'll include a little link about more if you want to learn more about the JSON tool change, which is very simple. So I think that takes us to you, Mr. Trudeau.
All right. So Python already supports a bunch of different compression formats like ZIP, GZ, and more, but this release adds a new one called Z Standard, which as a Canadian is hard to say, should be said. This is a new format by the folks at Meta/Facebook. It's a fast, lossless algorithm with fairly decent compression ratios. Now, along with introducing this, they've added a new module called compression, and all of the existing compression algorithms are being moved into it. This is a little more organized and makes it a little easier to find. The old locations will still work in order to maintain backwards compatibility. They haven't even deprecated it yet, and they're promising not to do that until at least 5 years after 3.14. So you've got time to catch up on that if you want. And then the next thing I want to talk about is a couple of changes to dealing with numbers. The first change is about how complex numbers behave. A complex number has two parts, the real part and the imaginary part, which is a horrible and confusing name, but I won't get into that tangent. Complex numbers are the result when you square root a negative number, and due to their having two components, they often get used in engineering and other places when you need a vector of size 2. Python supports complex numbers directly, and when you construct a complex number object, you pass in two numbers, one for the real part and one for the imaginary part. The parts can be integers or floats, and this leads to the weirdness and the change in 3.14. So, quick tangent first. Floating point numbers support two different states that aren't what you would consider a normal number. The first is NaN, short for not a number, and it's also a really tasty bread product. NaN is a placeholder for things that don't make sense numerically, like dividing zero by zero. On top of that, floats also support infinity, and in fact, you can even do math with them. It knows how to do 3 times infinity. It still gives you infinity. Now, here's our problem. Before Python 3.14, if you create a complex number with infinity as the real part and NaN as the imaginary part, and then do math on that number, the NaN leaks, and you end up with NaN in the real and NaN in the imaginary. This is problematic because it's not quite right, but worse, it isn't how the C99 standard says it's supposed to behave, which means all those folks writing C extensions that handle complex numbers have to jump through hoops to go back and forth between Python and the C extension. So Python 3.14 now corrects this, and the real part stays infinite even after operations. So this is a edge case, but it's kind of interesting. The other feature introduced in 3.14 related to numbers has to do with the underscore separator. In Python, you can write a number with an underscore in it and have the underscore ignored. This is handy with numbers with lots of digits. So 10 underscore 3 zeros is a little easier to read than 1 and 4 zeros. And in fact, that's sort of going forwards, but going backwards from the number to that, you can use the F-string formatter to print them out that way as well. Prior to Python 3.14, this was only supported on the left side of the decimal place, so whole numbers. You can now specify separators on the right side of the decimal place as well. So if you've got a really long fractional portion of a float, you can stick underscores in there for readability as well.
I talked about the concept of adding the complex numbers to Python with Travis Oliphant. That was one of these things that was a big stepping stone in the development of Python and why a lot of people were sort of looking at it as a language for data science and all these other scientific advancements. So,
yeah, and there's a little, I don't know, Easter egg of history in there, because they actually use the engineering style J for the imaginary part rather than the I.
Yeah.
And evidently there were arguments about it at one point in time, but it kind of tells you that this was coming out of data science and engineer types rather than coming out of the mathematic types. So
yeah. So Bartosz, what's your first?
Well, I'm just looking at my list, and my next one is lazy annotations in Python. But before we actually move into that, I want to quickly touch on what Chris mentioned before, the new Z standard compression algorithm that is now in Python. You mentioned that it was created by Meta and people from Facebook, but actually the underlying algorithm, it's called Asymmetric Numeral Systems, or ANS. This is actually an invention by a professor with whom I had the pleasure to work with at my university, the Jagiellonian University.
Oh, cool.
His name is Jarek Duda. And he was actually, he's the author of the algorithm, the ANS method that Facebook and others have started using. Yeah, that was just a brief, just wanted to give him a shout out.
Yeah, nice shout out there.
Yeah.
I think Facebook's getting credited because they're the ones who wrote the C library underneath that Python's attaching to. So I suspect that's where that reference comes from in the notes.
Yeah, and the reason why this algorithm is now available in Python is because it's ubiquitous. It's pretty much everywhere. It makes compression really, really reliable and more powerful. And that's what powers streaming services, for example. All right. Anyway, talking about the lazy annotations, this is a bit of a rabbit hole. I wrote an entire tutorial, which is 10,000 words long. So obviously, we're not going to cover everything.
Yep. Links in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely go and read that tutorial if you want to learn more. It's also covered in our final cool new features tutorial about Python 3.14. So from my perspective, this is actually one of the biggest changes that's coming in this release. It's long awaited. Lazy annotations is something that the community has been asking for a really, really long time. And this was pushed from one release to another over the years. But it's finally here. And let me give you a little bit of historical context to better understand why that was. So for those who are already familiar with type annotations in Python, what's changing in this release is that Python no longer evaluates annotation expressions eagerly. So as soon as it sees them, it no longer evaluates them. In other words, it doesn't compute them into values. Instead, in Python 3.14, annotations are implemented as data descriptors, which allows Python to delay the moment they're evaluated. And they're also cached. So Python only evaluates those annotations when you explicitly ask for them. And the subsequent attempts to access those annotations will not result in, you know, redundant computations because they're already cached. In fact, you can have an annotation that raises a runtime exception. So you can put something like 1/0, which would raise a zero division error. And in the previous Python releases, that would break your program. It wouldn't run at all. Whereas now you can have these annotations, and as long as you don't touch them, because you don't need annotations typically for runtime, it's usually for type checking, although that's not always the case, you won't need Python to evaluate them. So you can have valid Python code, which produces exceptions. And why this shift? Why are we going from eager to lazy evaluation? Why does it matter at all? So this shift addresses some common edge cases that you would encounter in type hinting scenarios, like reduced startup times, because the more complex your annotation expressions, the longer it takes for Python to compute them, even though you wouldn't typically need them to actually run your code, because they're typically intended for type checkers that read those annotations to validate your code. So that was a bit wasteful. But perhaps more importantly, you would often end up with unresolved references. So say you have a class, maybe a data class that has a field which declares an attribute of a type that is defined in the same file, but a little further down. So before Python had a chance to read the definition. In that case, you would have an error. So in the previous Python versions, what you could do is either arrange your classes in a different order so that the definitions that you'd refer to appear first, but that's not always possible. So in those cases, you would have the option to use something called a forward reference, where you essentially wrap your types in string literals, and that will make no difference to Python. It won't complain because it doesn't see a missing name. It's just a string. But at the same time, type checkers like MyPy or the new TY or a bunch of others, would cope with those strings just as fine as before. Or in Python 3.7, there was actually an attempt to address this issue. This was called postpone evaluation of annotations. And you could enable it per module by using the special from underscore underscore future underscore underscore import annotations directive. And that would change the semantics. So that also triggered a sort of lazy, well, it wasn't really an evaluation, because what it did was that Python would completely stop evaluating annotations. Instead, it would turn them into string literals. So in other words, Python would turn those annotations into forward declarations for you so that you don't have to manually go through your code and wrap them into string literals. And this was done with a bit of low-level magic in the C code, which Guido even commented out on GitHub that, yeah, it looks a bit hairy, that, to use his words. And that was actually, that was a good solution that solved some of the type hinting scenario edge cases. And it was destined to become the default in Python 3.10, and then it was postponed to Python 3.11. And then it was eventually superseded by this new specification, which implements annotations as data descriptors, which has some advantages. Perhaps I shouldn't go into too much detail. The bottom line is that those annotations, people use annotations for different purposes. So in most cases, they use annotations for type hinting. But on the other end of the spectrum, you have libraries like Pydantic or FastAPI, which use annotations for other purposes, along with type hinting, namely data validation, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
So that solution that was proposed earlier in Python 3.7, it solved the type hinting scenario, but it completely broke down the other scenario. So now we have a solution that elegantly makes both camps happy. The annotations can be still evaluated. Previously, with this from future import annotations directive, libraries would have to do their own evaluation, which wasn't always easy or possible. Now Python still evaluates annotations, but it just does it later. So it's deferred or lazy. And on top of that, you have new API, and you can request different formats for these annotations to fit your scenario, to fit your use cases. So you can, for example, request annotations to be evaluated into values, into Python objects, which then can be used for things like dependency injection, for example. Or you can have them as strings or forward references. So this would be good for type checking, if you want to do type checking at runtime to enforce the types. Yeah, so I think that's that in a nutshell, but I'd encourage everyone to go and read that tutorial, which probably does a better job of putting everything in perspective.
I'm sure it's filled with examples and
oh, yes.
Lots of stuff for people to dig into much further. Yeah. It takes me to my next thing, which is about error messages. I've spoken about this many times. In fact, I had Pablo Galindo Salgado on the show. His name will come up again in something I'm going to speak about in a minute. Episode 105, we talked about better error messages in 3.10 and 3.11. And boy, that's just keeps happening again and again. A new parser was implemented in 3.9 and then 3.10, the PEG parser, which made a huge difference and allowed what he described as infinite look ahead. And it allowed the core developers to improve many of the error messages. And each release, again, has added more. And they've become much, much more specific about things, doing a form of like underlining of stuff with either little tilde sort of squiggle characters or carrots pointing at very specific things in your line code instead of the old style, just syntax error and then whatever line of code was there and you scratching your head as to what happened. We've written a bunch of tutorials on each of these releases and discussed these updates across all the different podcasts we've done on the releases on the show. I'll mention a few here. They've done a better job with keywords specifically. If you've done like a typo, maybe you're trying to type 4 and you added an extra R there, it will actually will specifically say, well, oh, did you mean 4, the keyword 4? You get better information as far as LF. If you did like an LIF after an else block error, more explicit conditional expressions. Again, moving from something like syntax error, invalid syntax, to syntax error, expected expression after else, but given statement. So things like that. If you were to do something with strings and have double quoted string literal inside of a longer string literal that had the same double quotes on it, it might actually go ahead and underline that specific little phrase inside there and said, is this intended to be part of the string? which is really kind of neat. I like that. Unpacking assignment expressions has become much more specific. Value error, too many values to unpack. Expected two, got three, stuff like that. And a very elaborate one for async, which I thought was interesting, much, much more descriptive for async with usage errors. That it used to be something like type error, task group object does not support the context manager protocol. And now it actually provides like about four lines of information. Type error, async.io.taskgroups object does not support the context manager protocol, missed exit, but it supports the asynchronous context manager protocol. Did you mean to use async with? So it's again, leading you on a path to find a solution for your errors, which is great. And it was a lot of stuff that was very, very helpful for beginners. And now I feel like they're moving toward more and more of these advanced use cases. Philip Exeni wrote up our preview tutorial on this. So there's a Python 3.14 preview, better syntax error messages for you to check out on site. And that brings me back to Christopher. What's your next one?
I don't know if you've ever looked at a chunk of code and sort of scratched your head as to what it was supposed to do. Well, one of those situations in Python can happen with try except finally blocks. Like, say you're catching an exception, and in the exception part, you return the value of 13. Then you add a finally block where you return the value of 42. Well, just what is supposed to happen? You see, the exception is supposed to be caught, and it's going to return in the exception, but the whole idea behind a finally is that it always runs no matter what. So just what's it supposed to do? Well, Python's behavior is that the finally triggers, and that's because finally is always supposed to run, which makes sense, but looking at the code, it's a little ambiguous. In order to try and alleviate this ambiguity, Python 3.14 has added a syntax warning. So if you use a return, a continue, or a break inside of a finally block, you'll get warned. There was some talk about making this a syntax error instead, but the constant bugbear of backward compatibility reared its head, and so the steering committee settled on a warning instead. So you don't come across these in the field very often, and in fact, I remember reading somebody actually did a troll through GitHub to see how frequently it happened. But it is one of those that's a bit of a foot gun, and so you know the warning is helpful.
Cool. Bartosz, what do you got next?
Yeah, so my next new feature in Python 3.14 is a bit of a low-level C API available in CPython interpreter, and it's exposing a new capability for external debuggers by allowing them to hook up to a live, long-running Python program, like a web server, for example, and the built-in PDB debugger that comes with Python that you can run from the terminal now takes a new command line parameter with the process ID you want to hook into. So this allows you to step through the code, set breakpoints, inspect, and even change variables as if you started that process through the debugger in the first place. So it sounds pretty powerful. You do need to have both the Python program that is running and the debugger to be executed through Python 3.14 or above with this new capability, obviously. And additionally, you'll most likely need to run your debugger as a super user because you need those elevated privileges to access memory of a separate process. But I played around with it. It looks cool. Definitely the advantages of this new API is a unified interface for external debuggers, which up to this point had to rely on internal details that could change. Now it's just a standard thing that they can start using. There's also a change in the Python API. So the sys module has a new function called remote exec, which also takes a process ID of another Python program. And this allows you to execute arbitrary Python code within the context of a separate process. So it sounds a bit insecure. And for these reasons, you can disable this feature altogether. To do that, you have to make a custom Python build by compiling it from source code using a special flag that will disable it. And that's what you can run in your production if you don't want to risk someone hooking up to your process and messing around with it. But yeah, like I said, I played around with it. I made a super simple HTTP server, let it sit in the background, and then I connected to it through using the PDB debugger. But in the future, there will be probably plenty of external debuggers that will leverage this feature, so you will be able to do much more sophisticated things, especially in multi-threaded contexts. So when I use PDB, it expects the main thread to exist, and that's what it hooks up into. I had some issues with async code, though, because it runs on a single thread, and if there's no incoming requests, it's blocked. So the first time you connect to it using PDB or any other debugger, you don't see any output. You have to trigger the event loop so that things start moving around. But yeah, it's a little feature that it's perhaps less flashy, but can be convenient when you need to do some debugging.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of hooks and connections being added. I don't know what the term is in construction where you're like fleshing out the things where you think of like, well, these are areas where we might build out. And it's been interesting watching the construction project that is the recent versions of Python. So my next one is about Pathlib. If you're not familiar with Pathlib and you're not using it, man, it's a great improvement for working with the file system in Python. We have lots of resources if you're not using it currently on RealPython where you can learn a lot more about it. But with it, you create a path object that abstracts a file name and it's used to access the file itself. And there's lots of methods and things as far as working with your files that way. And they've added four new methods. The first one is copy and then copy into. The first one copies a file to a destination where the second copies a file into a specific directory. Similarly, there are two new ones that are for move calls that do basically the same types of things, moving to a destination or moving into a specific directory. And they've added a new attribute of .info, and this attribute is on the path object. It'll show information about if the file exists, is this a directory, is it a plain file, is it a symlink. Some Pathlib users might be scratching their heads. Those calls exist already directly on the path, but the info attribute gets populated automatically when you iterate on a directory, and it caches certain information, as such as if there's a warning that the contents might not be correct. So this is kind of a new change, and it'll be interesting to see how it applies and, you know, how it's different from how people might have been using that before. But yeah, it's always nice to see new things added to Pathlib. And the second one I want to talk about is unit test. Unit test.testcase has 8 new assertion methods, 2 that check different attributes, 2 for checking subclassing, 2 for starts and ends with, different ways to build up your testing library a little bit more. Unit test is also one of those command modules that now has color highlighting that they've been adding in other areas. Chris, what do you got for us next?
Frequent listeners to the show have probably heard us talk about the next feature a little bit, so I'll try and keep this short. Python 3.14 introduces T-strings. T-string looks like an F-string, but with a T prefix instead, and it uses the exact same parser as the F-string system, but instead of returning a string, it returns a template object. The template object contains the constituent parts of the string. So let's say you had a T-string with the text cost and then a brace bracketed field with a 2-decimal float formatter. If you did, I'd question why you were using for floats for money. Bad programmer. You're not supposed to do that. But ignoring that, the resulting template object would contain the plain string portion, cost, and then what's called an interpolation object. That's what represents the brace bracketed field. The interpolation object contains whatever you represented, like the variable being used, as well as any calculation that went with it. And then on top of that, you can get at the formatter information as well as a few other things. The impetus behind T-strings is that in some software, it's handy to do processing on the parts of the F-string before using the result, and the T-string sort of gives you a shim to be able to do that. One common use case is in escaping user input. For example, an SQL library would allow the user to use a T-string as inputs, then run text escaping on the content before actually using it in a query. Another use case is when you need to do multiple things with the same string. It's becoming common for logging systems to log both a human and machine-readable message for automation processes, and with a T-string, the handler could output both types. Template objects themselves are really for library builders, but as libraries start to use this feature, you might be constructing T-strings in order to pass them into the API calls in the near future. It'll be interesting to see what comes with this. In fact, I came across a new library for building HTML snippets that takes advantage of it for exactly the reasons I was talking about for escaping user input inside of the code just today. So
yeah,
stuff is coming.
Yeah, it's continuing that idea of like fleshing out all these different stems and so forth that can be used as we keep growing Python. Yeah, speaking about big changes inside of Python, Bartosz, what do you got next here?
Well, actually, I want to quickly comment on Chris's T-strings because I personally, when I first saw them, they looked to me like a nice feature looking for a problem. For what it's worth, Python has already a number of built-in ways to specify string templates, interpolate them. We also have many resources at RealPython that talk about them. Yeah, and to me, what makes T-strings confusing is that they look so remarkably similar to F-strings, and it's really easy to confuse them, yet they produce completely different results. The other point of confusion that I had was that the new Python 3.14 supports the syntax, but it doesn't really provide you with any standard library modules to process those. So at the moment, you must either write your own T-string processors if you want to really take advantage of them, or you need to hunt down for third-party libraries, which probably there aren't that many. I know that Python 3.15, the next year's release, is scheduled to have some use of T-strings in the standard library, in Schleck's module, I believe, and the other one. But yeah, so far you won't get far with T-strings unless you do a little bit of work yourself. Anyway, this was just my quick rant I wanted to put out there. My next link coming to Python 3.14 isn't a new thing at all. It's actually something that was introduced in Python 3.13 back a year ago, and it's called free-threaded build, sometimes called the no-gil build. So as you know, or maybe not, Python has the gil, or global interpreter lock, and it's a thing that is in the interpreter, and it essentially prevents multiple threads from running in parallel. And a lot of people have been complaining about it and pushing for its removal. It's not happening yet. I think some people got confused and overly excited about Python removing the gil, but that's not the case, mostly for compatibility reasons. Last year release made free-threaded Python optional. It's still optional, but it's now officially supported. Previously, it was an experiment, so you would have to use it at your own risk. Now it has the official support, so things look promising. But for the time being, we were left with two incompatible Python builds. When you use tools like PyENV, for example, to manage multiple Python versions on your computer, when you look for the versions to install, starting from 3.13, each version has actually two flavors, the vanilla one, so to say, and the free-threaded one without the gil. If you want to play with the free-threaded build, you would typically have to compile it from source code yourself using a set of special flags, and we have that covered as well on RealPython. But perhaps I should quickly explain what the deal is. So without the gil, yes, you get potentially better performance in multi-threaded code, but at the same time, the price is the single-threaded code typically runs a bit slower. So that's the trade-off you need to be aware of. Apart from that, because we have now these two incompatible Python builds, if your code depends on a third-party library which uses native code, something that is compiled down to machine code like NumPy or Pandas, then the vendor must provide a specific build for that particular Python flavor, which means extra work because now they have to maintain and build those artifacts for different Python versions. And it means that not every library will be compatible with both Python flavors. So if you want to use a library in the no-gil version, it might just not work, and also the other way around. Or even if you're using the Python without the gil and it's disabled, then for backward compatibility, the interpreter might actually decide to re-enable the gil, even though you've disabled it, just to make sure that your code won't break down and it will continue to work. So I find this feature to be a bit controversial. I think people are overly excited about it. Even though it's no longer experimental, it's officially supported. You know, we're still in this sort of interim period of time where we're not really sure how things will look like. Yeah.
I wonder about the landscape. Like, have you looked at what libraries have embraced it?
I have not. I mean, I remember there someone maintains this website which shows what the support level is. And for the most part, I mean, the most popular libraries are typically supported. So you would have to be really unlucky not to get the support.
Okay. But you got to definitely be paying attention.
For now, I think the biggest trade-off is the penalty you have to pay for the single-threaded execution path. So if you use the no-gil build and you run your regular single-threaded code, you will likely observe a hit in performance. And we did some experiments last year when we were covering this feature for the first time. And I was getting widely different results depending on the computer that I was running, the different operating systems. And yeah, the results were quite inconsistent, to be honest. So my recommendation would be to check out one of our tutorials called How to Bypass the Python Gil, which covers a number of different tools and options you have to make your threads run in parallel within Python, although it's no longer Python technically. Anyway.
Yeah. Mr. Trudeau just shared something with me, and I'll include it in here. There's a Python free threading guide with a compatibility status tracking chart. So I'll include that.
Awesome.
If people are interested. So thanks, Chris. So my next thing is another area where they've been looking at improving performance. And this one is about the garbage collector. And the garbage collector, if you're not familiar with it, it frees up memory of objects that are no longer being used. The main garbage collector algorithm used by CPython is through reference counting. This is a deep subject, and I'm not going to go very deep in it. I'll provide links for you. There is a very, very detailed document by Pablo Galindo Salgado, person I mentioned earlier, actually on GitHub. It's the internal docs on the garbage collector and what the changes are. He mentions changes to the headers of objects, this PyGC_head that's being added, which I think is interesting. The default build implementation is still a generational collector, or I guess has been a generational collector. And the free threaded build is non-generational. Each collection scans the entire heap. They simplified things and improved the pause times between collections, but there's a lot of under-the-hood tinkering going on here to make all this stuff happen, but it is something they've been working on and looking at ways to improve. Pablo also has a podcast that he does with Wukish Langa, who I've also had on the show, and I think they had an episode where they dive pretty deep into it. They always have a humorous way of approaching some of these deeper topics, so if you're interested in getting rather nerdy about garbage collection, that might be another resource for you.
I just want to quickly comment on that as well. I don't know if people remember, but this new kind of garbage collector was actually supposed to come into Python 3.13. It was scheduled to be a part of the last year's release, but it was the very reason why Python 3.13 got delayed by a week, because the release manager decided to essentially roll it back, extract it from the code at the very last minute because it was causing some performance issues. But now they polished it out and apparently it's working.
Yeah, get another year worth of testing on it, I guess, right?
Yeah.
All right. So the other thing I want to mention is just a quick one. The import time for 22 modules have been improved, including really common ones like string, subprocess, threading, and becoming more common, TOMLib. So lots of interesting stuff happening there as far as little improvements. And that takes me back to Mr. Trudeau.
Yeah, my next one is an improvement to the partial function inside of the functools module. If you haven't played with partial before, it's a function which helps you construct functions. So it's all very meta, and I don't mean the MySpace ripoff. So this might be a little easier to explain with an example. So you may have heard of the Playwright library. It's used for programmatically reading from the web. You point it at a web page, and then your code can interact with it as if it were a person. This is great for scraping and writing integration tests. And one of the things you can do in Playwright is register a callback against certain kinds of content. So say you wanted to do something with every image on the page. Rather than parse the page yourself, you just register a callback against images, and Playwright will call your function for every image it finds. So that's the scenario. Now the challenge is the callback registration for Playwright takes a reference to a function, and as such, you can't pass arguments into the function. It has to be a bare declaration. So other libraries get around this problem, but for whatever reason, Playwright has decided not to. So one way of handling this is you can take your existing function that you wanted, that needed some arguments, and then use the functools partial call. You call partial with the reference to your function and the arguments that you want to pass your function, and partial returns a new function reference, which then is that's the one that you can register for Playwright. So Python automatically then puts your arguments into the function when Playwright calls it, and this solves your problem. The limiting factor in this is that the partial previously only took keyword arguments. There was no way to specify positional arguments, and that has to do with how it's constructed, the form of the declaration. And it kind of makes sense, but I'm sure you probably can guess where this is going. Python 3.14 introduces a new object called a placeholder, and that's exactly what it does. It holds a spot in the call for a partial. This means now when you construct partials, you can mix positional and keyword arguments together, giving you more flexibility in the kinds of functions you might use with your functools partial. So it's a small thing, but if you're playing with this kind of stuff, it can make a big difference.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And it's the one we discussed at the top of the show, titled What's New in Python 3.14. And in the course, my frequent co-host, Christopher Trudeau, takes you through the new features and improvements like a smarter and more colorful REPL experience, error messages that guide you toward fixes, safer hooks for live debugging, template strings, or T-strings, for controlled interpolation, deferred annotation evaluation to simplify typing, and new concurrency options like sub-interpreters and the free threaded build. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Bartosz, what do you got next?
Well, this is my last one. This was actually introduced together with the experimental free-threaded build last year. So there's not a lot changing in Python 3.14. It's unlike the free-threaded build, JIT, or just-in-time compiler, remains experimental in Python 3.14. So you need to compile Python source code with special flags, which are different from different operating systems. But what is changing in Python 3.14 regarding this feature is there is now a new standard library module called sys.underscore.jit, which defines a few utility functions which help you check the status of the JIT. So previously, this was a little bit cumbersome because you would have to check the flags with which Python was compiled. Now it's a little bit higher level API, which is more straightforward to use. And first of all, it allows you to check if your Python build supports the JIT at all. That is, if it was compiled with the JIT compile support. Secondly, you can check whether it's enabled for your particular process. Depending on the operating system, the JIT can be supported by default or not. So it's usually best to be explicit and use a Python JIT environment variable to set it. So that way you know whether Python will run with JIT, even regardless of whether it supports one or not. And also there's a third function which you can use to check whether the JIT is actually running, but this one is reserved for low-level debugging only. So you'll be probably more concerned with the first two. Yeah, it's important to note that this module, the name of the module starts with an underscore, which means that it's an internal module, so it's subject to change, and even it could be removed in the future. The other thing that I think comes with this release is that if you use the official Python installers for macOS or Windows, then those Pythons will already have the just-in-time compiler supported. Yeah, so you don't have to compile Python with the special JIT support yourself. It's there. It's only when you need to build one for Linux or perhaps some other operating systems. And the name for Windows, the name of the flag for Windows is dash dash experimental JIT. And for the other ones is dash dash enable experimental JIT. Yeah, but I probably should have started by explaining what JIT is. I just quickly covered that. So JIT stands for just-in-time compiler. Python is an interpreter language, so it means that your code is high-level and portable. You can write essentially a piece of text and put it on macOS, on Windows, or Linux, whatever. Each platform has to have a specific Python interpreter built for that platform, which takes that text and turns it into action. So it interprets the code and translates it into machine code on the fly and executes it. Whereas a just-in-time compiler is a type of compiler which first looks at your code, tries to find hotspots or pieces of code that takes the most time to compute, to execute, and these are worthy of compiling down to machine code native to your platform, and it does it while your program is running. So the trade-off is that you may observe slowdowns during the execution of your program, but then if you run this piece of code, which is expensive, you know, sufficiently many times, over time, you will get the benefit. And again, this is a feature that was already available back in 3.13 last year. We were playing around with it, and it was a bit underwhelming, to be honest. Maybe there's been some changes this release. I haven't checked myself. But yeah, I think the most important thing to remember is that it remains experimental, so use it only at your own risk. There are some external just-in-time compilers for Python that you can use in the form of third-party libraries or other tools.
It's funny, I feel like the JIT and free threading they're going to be specific use cases, all of them. And so it's one of these things that you probably are becoming more and more familiar with them if it's something that's in the area of Python that you're working in, and it kind of makes sense. You know, if there's code that runs very specific hotspots, like you said, like repeated areas and things like that, where it makes sense, and you might have already been looking at something like PyPy is one, right?
Yep.
And a couple other ones that you might have heard of. So, but it's interesting to see them continue to look at ways of, well, how can we speed stuff up? And then unfortunately often happens as we look at creating it during the construction process, it's a little maybe slower initially. So.
Yeah, PyPy is great. You can use your existing Python source code and run it through PyPy, which is an alternative interpreter. Interestingly enough, implemented in Python itself, and you will typically observe much, much better performance because of its just-in-time compiler built in.
Yeah, yeah. That one's spelled PyPy. Oh, always gets mixed up from people who think of PyPI.
Right. That can be confusing. I think with Python 3.14, with this year's release, we have something that has the potential to improve the performance. And I think this is quite interesting. I'm not sure if one of you planned to cover it. I'm talking about the sub-interpreters.
That's next.
Oh, okay, that's perfect.
Yeah. You ready to go on it?
Yeah. So speaking of the interpreters, it saves me having to sort of explain what those are, so I can just kind of skip ahead. For years now, CPython has actually supported running multiple interpreters at the same time. These are known as the sub-interpreters, but they've only actually been available to extension writers. So it's been there under the covers, but not really available in the language. There's been a bunch of work going on in this space for the last three releases. And finally, Python 3.14 fully exposes the sub-interpreters to Python, the language. So if you've done any concurrent coding in Python, you've probably come across the pool executors. These are context managers that help you set up some concurrent execution, particularly how many concurrent things are going on at once. There's an executor for threads, there's another one for processes, and now there is one for sub-interpreters. This is pretty good news. Threads share memory, and so if you're not careful, you can run into race conditions. Processes don't have that problem, but are heavier weight and require a whole bunch of overhead because you're triggering stuff going on in the operating system. With processes, their memory is protected. The good news is you're not going to stomp over other pieces of memory and you don't have race conditions. The bad news is if you want to share memory, now you have to do it explicitly. So sub-interpreters are kind of a nice little compromise between the two. Each interpreter has its own memory space, so you get the protection of the processes, but they also run inside of the same operating system process, so there's a lot less overhead. Also, a version or two back, they also redid the GIL so that it was sub-interpreter specific. So if you're not yet running free-threaded code, a lot of the locks that you run into with, say, threaded code go away because the GIL is specific to the sub-interpreter. Now, the downside of this is you still have to do extra steps to share memory between them, and some extensions aren't quite compatible with this mode yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to playing around with this.
Me too.
Well, I think it leaves me with one little collection of miscellaneous stuff. Every year, or so, I should say, the Unicode group meets to decide what are the new emojis and so forth and what is changing in the Unicode standard. It recently was updated, I guess in 2024 was 16.0.0. We lag a little bit here in Python, but that's the version that now has been added. That Unicode database is now inside of Python 3.14. So there's a bunch of new symbols and emojis that you'll be able to use if that's something you put inside your code. The most recent update, which I think is maybe a little hard for them to implement, was version 17 came out in September of this year. So one other kind of tiny thing that's interesting, I think of it kind of as an Easter egg, going back to a conversation that I had with Bartosz, is they have made a way to run in your virtual environment Python, Pi being the Pi symbol, and T-H-O-N. Christopher and I had to look it up how you would find that character. It's the mathematical italic small Pi Unicode character. I'll include a link if you'd like it. But yeah, you'll see it if you create a virtual environment as another way that you can invoke Python. Again, opening up the REPL or opening up files from there, you can type Python or Python 3 or Python. So
yeah, that was a little painful. There's about a half dozen different things that are pie-shaped inside of Unicode. And of course, it's a character. You have to get the right one.
Yeah.
So it's cute that it's there, but it may not be easily found on your keyboard. Yeah,
yeah. It was right. U plus 1D70B for those Unicode heads out there, right?
Doesn't work on Windows, though. It's only macOS and Linux where you have symbolic links. Those aliases. And it only works on Python 3.14. So if you install 3.15 next year, it won't work.
Okay.
It just works for this one.
It's a short-term Easter egg. Yeah. There's lots of little stuff inside changes-wise. Yeah, that's why we have what, four different preview articles. And then, of course, your cool new features one that has just come out this week. Mm-hmm. And usually when we had Girana on, we would do a kind of a quick wrap-up of like, what do we think of the changes? And then how likely are you to start using it right away, or advice that we have for others? And personally, again, I do a lot of stuff from scratch. And I'm testing a lot of our own video courses and other projects. So it will probably be pretty quick here that I'll be embracing 3.14 and making sure everything runs across it. I don't have a lot of code that's going to be breaking right now. I'm getting in the process of building some newer projects. So I'm pretty happy to be able to work from there. I know, Chris, you've been working on a few different projects and actually been deprecating older versions of Python yourself. So how's it look for you?
Yeah, from the teaching perspective, I spend a lot of time in the REPL. And so the colorization, the syntax highlighting there is helpful. I think it makes it clearer for the students to be able to see it.
Yeah.
Similar, and we've kind of talked about this before, with the error message improvements. Those are things that seem like small things, but when you're actually hitting the errors, them being clearer makes your day-to-day more useful. I guess the caveat I think we almost always say here is, who's your target audience, right? So if you're building something for yourself or others who are operating the same version that you are, then yeah, whatever, you might as well take advantage of it. For library maintainers who are having to maintain things that are across multiple versions that different people are using, you know, you tend to be slower to adapt some of those kinds of things, right? Like,
yeah,
I only started using the Walrus operator in my libraries this year for exactly that reason, because when it was introduced and how, you know, now everybody is up to that level. And so I was comfortable enough to deprecate older libraries, right? So there's always a lag there if you're trying to support other systems.
Yeah, I think people really need to watch out, especially in the data science world. That seems to be the one that lags the most for me. These large packages with lots and lots of dependencies, often you may be using a much older version than, you know, what's current.
Seth Larson posted something today talking about the fact that he had a bet as to whether or not the 6 compatibility library would still be in the top 10 PyPI downloads by this year. It's like 5 years ago they said, no, it would be gone. And it's still there. It's number, sorry, it wasn't the top 10, it was the top 20, because it's number 14. Yeah. So, you know, obviously there's still people out there who are trying to be backwardly compatible with Python 2. Otherwise, that library would have sort of slipped from its frequent download place. So yeah, there's folks who are always running the latest version, and there's lots of folks who still aren't.
Yeah. If you want more information on that, you can always check out our history video course we did about all the versions of Python. So
yes.
Yeah. Bartosz, what do you think? Where are you at as far as adoption and using 3.14?
Well, personally, when I do educational work, I don't have any limits. I'm typically on the cutting edge. So I've already switched to 3.14, and I'll definitely take advantage of the new features, especially the new lazy evaluation of annotations that will definitely simplify things. That will mean I will no longer have to use forward declarations. But in reality and real life projects, which run somewhere in the cloud, you know, there are constraints, especially if you run a production application, then you're constrained to a specific Python version, which might not be the latest one. Plus, there's always a risk of when you do migrations, all sorts of things can go wrong. So for many people out there, it probably won't happen overnight. But I wish more and more people started using type hints in their code.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on the show again. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah.
Happy Pi Day.
Yeah. Happy Pi Day, everybody. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau and Bartosz Jachinski for joining me this week on the show. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.